Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions.
What does it mean? To be American.
I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for this latest in our series Democracy Optimist with University of Kentucky election and voting law research professor Joshua Douglas. In this episode 31 of our series, Josh has a conversation with Rachel Ray of the Lexington-based International Book Project about the connection between literacy, civic engagement, and democracy, and how making books readily available to everybody is linked to civic health. First, voter turnout, specifically those of us who do care about a particular issue but don't vote on election day. In this episode, Josh Douglas explores a particular set of those would-be voters.
Public opinion is strong and passionate on many issues, yet voter participation remains low and uneven in many elections. Some Americans are single-issue voters. They organize their political choices around one overriding concern: abortion, immigration, taxes, criminal justice, or even sustaining democracy itself. There are also a lot of single-issue non-voters out there, people who care a lot about a certain issue but still don't participate in elections, perhaps because they don't think they can make a difference. Climate change is certainly one of those topics. The scientific consensus is clear. The Earth is warming at an unprecedented rate due to human activity. The consequences are already visible: extreme weather, rising sea levels, destabilized ecosystems. And yet, despite widespread public concern, environmental issues do not always translate into voter turnout. Politics, of course, can play a major role on climate change. President Trump, for example, issued an executive order withdrawing the United States from the Paris Agreement, a major international treaty designed to coordinate global climate mitigation, arguing that it hurt the U.S. economy. Will that action motivate voters to show up in November? More broadly, how well does democracy work if people who care deeply about an existential issue don't turn out to vote? Our guest today has spent the past decade working on this very issue. Nathaniel Stinnett is the founder and CEO of the Environmental Voter Project, which uses sophisticated data analytics and behavioral science to identify environmentalists who are registered to vote but who do not regularly cast ballots, and then works to turn them into consistent voters. Nathaniel, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Oh, thanks, Josh. I'm really excited to be here.
So this organization, the Environmental Voter Project, launched in 2017. What problem did you see in American politics that convinced you that this was the sort of organization that needed to exist?
Well, simply put, I saw that the climate and environmental movement didn't have nearly enough political power. And I saw it in real time working on a whole bunch of campaigns where I'm from up in Massachusetts. I worked on local, state, and federal elections. And no matter the campaign, when we polled voters to ask them what issues they cared about deeply, very, very few of them, I mean 1-2% at most, would list climate change and the environment as their top priority. And that's just not enough to get a candidate and to get a campaign to focus on a particular issue. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that there simply wasn't enough voter demand for climate leadership, and we had to fix that.
Because this is, in your view, one of the most important issues that faces our democracy?
Absolutely. Not just our democracy in the United States, but it's one of the biggest issues facing humanity. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people die each year because of air pollution and water pollution. The greenhouse gases that we are pumping into the atmosphere aren't just killing enormous numbers of Americans on a regular basis. They're also leading to horrific things like child asthma attacks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen a child have an asthma attack, Josh, but it is horrifying It is an absolutely awful thing. And so these are real life disasters that are already occurring. We're not talking about polar bears and ice caps. We're talking about real harm that's hitting real people right now. And politicians aren't leading to try to address these issues, largely because they're not being forced to by our current political process.
And that relates to low voter turnout, you know, system-wide, but also your organization's focus on people who really care about these issues. So how do you identify these non-voting environmentalists that you hope to turn into regular voters?
Yeah, so what we do is we build what's called predictive models on voter files. And before I describe them, I just want to say, this is how most sophisticated political campaigns now target voters. No campaigns, none of the congressional or senator, gubernatorial or presidential campaigns now target broad demographic groups. Instead, all of them target on an individual basis, and they do it by building these predictive models. And very briefly, the way these things work is we start by polling huge numbers of people. We're talking tens of thousands of people. But we only ask one question. We say, hey, what's your number one most important political priority? And let's say a handful of people in each state say climate change or clean air or clean water. Well, then we isolate those people on voter files, and we work with data scientists to try to figure out what we know about them. What census data, what voter file data, what publicly available behavioral or consumer data we've got on them. And then we start building little profiles that help us try to find more people like them. And it's a long iterative process, but at the end of it, what we're able to do is assign a score to each individual voter in a state, telling us how likely they are to not just care about climate or the environment, but literally listed as their number one most important priority. And then the final step is, I think, the most interesting, but it's the one where we don't even need fancy data scientists. Once we've identified these people who are really likely to list climate as their top priority, well, then we need to figure out which of these environmentalists don't vote. And for that, Josh, all we need to do is look at public voting records. I don't know if your listeners know this, but who you vote for is secret, but whether you vote or not, that's public record. It's public record which elections you vote in and which elections you don't vote in. So that last step is actually really easy for us. Once we identify these environmentalists, we just get rid of the ones who are already voting, and we only focus on the ones who don't vote that often.
So I suspect some of our listeners might hear this and think, like, wow, that almost feels like, I don't know, an invasion of privacy, or, you know, to be kind of behind the scenes gathering all this information about them. What's your response to that potential concern?
My response is, yeah, they're right. It's a little creepy, isn't it? But you know what? So is the climate crisis, Josh. So is the democracy crisis. We are dealing with some enormous problems right now. And if using publicly available data, it's all publicly available, it's all already out there. Mm-hmm. If using publicly available data to find people who care about an issue and then encourage them to vote, if we could do that and build up political power to address this polycrisis of democracy failing and the climate failing all at the same time, well, you better believe I'm going to take advantage of those things. Absolutely.
So the organization identified about 11.2 million non-voting environmentalists. These are people who did not vote in the 2024 presidential election, but named some aspect of climate change or the environment as their number one issue. What would this look like if even, you know, say 1 million or 2 million of these people turned out to vote? How would that change our democracy?
Well, I mean, the last presidential election was decided by, what, roughly 130,000 votes in three states. Mm-hmm. We have a super tight division between Democrats and Republicans in both the U.S. House and the Senate. But then I also want to talk about climate policy making at the state and local level. I mean, states regulate utilities and fund transportation infrastructure. Cities decide building codes and zoning codes and traffic laws. And so all of these crucially important climate policies are made by people who run for office. And they run for office in elections that are increasingly decided by just a handful of votes. Just a handful of votes. So you ask, what would it mean if even a fraction of these non-voting environmentalists start voting? Well, the first thing it would mean is, boy, could it really determine some really important elections and change who gets elected. But the second thing is perhaps even more important, Josh. Remember what I was saying earlier about how it's public record whether you vote or not? Well, the first decision any campaign makes is they say, okay, we've got limited time, we've got limited money, and we need to get 50% plus one of the vote on a Tuesday in November. So what they do is they all sit around a table, they open their laptops, they look at these public voter files, and they see which of the people in their district have a history of voting in this election that they're trying to win, and which of them don't. And surprise, surprise, Josh, what these campaigns end up doing is they say, okay, well, we can't afford to talk to everybody. Let's only talk to the people who are actually likely to show up. And again, not to put too fine a point on it, Josh, but they literally know who these people are by name and street address.
Mm-hmm.
So this brings me back to the second reason why it would be such a huge difference if even a fraction of these environmentalists started voting. It's because politicians don't care about the priorities of non-voters. They only care about the priorities of voters. And if they only care about the priorities of voters, well, who do you think they're going to poll?
Of course.
They sure as heck aren't going to poll non-voters. Why on earth would they? They're just going to poll the people who show up. So simply by voting, environmentalists guarantee that politicians will start paying more attention to their priorities, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but rather because nothing motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election. Politicians go where the votes are, so environmentalists better be voters.
We're speaking with Nathaniel Stennett of the Environmental Voter Project. Talking about this push to November makes me think about how so many of our elections are actually not really decided in November because of partisan gerrymandering, something we've talked about a lot on the show previously. And so in many districts, we know the Democrats going to win or the Republicans going to win that particular race. And so it's the primaries that really make the biggest difference. And yet we also know that primaries are really low turnout affairs. So I guess my question for you with respect to environmentalist non-voters is how much are you pushing them to participate in the primaries, which, again, in many of the places where they live is the only election that matters, versus trying to get them to become voters in November?
It's a really, really great question, Josh. We work year-round, and I don't just say that as some pithy slogan. We really mean it. We were active in over 420 elections last year in 2025. 420. And that's not because all of those elections were important for climate policymaking.
Mm-hmm.
I freely admit many of them weren't. Rather, all of them were supremely important for changing people's habits. If you want to turn non-voters into new voters, into consistent voters, you need every bite at the apple you can get. And so one thing we do with the Environmental Voter Project is we view every election as a precious opportunity to talk to these non-voting environmentalists and mobilize them to vote. So yeah, we take primaries really, really seriously. We even take little special local elections seriously. In fact, Josh, we've mobilized non-voting environmentalists for library trustee elections and dog catcher races, because the only way to make a non-voter into a voter is to get them to start voting.
Yeah, and how do you sustain that, right? So let's say you get a voter who had not participated previously, who calls the environment their number one issue, and you convince them to vote in one election. How do you sustain that in the future?
It's a really, really great question. So there are two things at play here. The first is we keep on communicating with that voter until we determine that they have then become likely to vote in a particular election. And then we no longer contact them for elections such as that. So we're always making an election-specific determination as to whether one of these environmentalists is likely to vote or not. And it's important to keep going back at those voters because we often think of the act of voting as being sort of a one-time, almost cost-benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. Like a voter will decide whether they want to vote or not based on particular things having to do with that one election. But that's actually not how human beings act. Voting can be a potentially habit-forming behavior, just like exercising or eating healthy can be. And so, yes, if you get an environmentalist to vote for the first time, they are then more likely, even if you never talk to them again, to vote in the next election and the election after that. So we keep on communicating with them to build up that good habit. But the second thing I want to bring up, Josh, brings me back to that concept of the public voter file. I know I keep on mentioning it, but it's such an important concept. Because it is public record whether you vote or not, a really special thing happens when we get an environmentalist to vote for the first time. About 2 months after the election, public voter files in their state are updated, and it shows that they voted. And so let's say, in a state like Kentucky, we get someone to vote in a primary for the very first time. Well, a few months later, the record of them having voted shows up. And then, Josh, it's like there's a bright red beacon next to their name saying, hey, look at me. I just voted in this teeny low turnout election that no one cares about. And then everybody who is running this fall sees that and they say, holy moly. If that person votes in a low turnout primary, they're definitely going to vote in our election. We got to go get them. And what's more, we got to poll them to figure out what issues they care about. So it's like we've sent a signal to the rest of the marketplace that, hey, there's a new voter here. They're now a first-class citizen. You have to pay attention to them. And that is a positive feedback loop that then makes them even more likely to vote because it's like the public record of them having voted has brought the cavalry in, and now everybody is knocking on their door making sure that they vote.
And it sort of explains the political science literature, which does demonstrate that one of the biggest predictors of someone is going to vote is whether they voted previously. And as you said, voting
is habitual creatures.
Is definitely habit forming in that way. I'm fascinated by this discussion of non-voters. In part, you and I have spoken offline about how I'm writing a book about non-voters. And so I'm wondering if you've seen this specifically about environmentalists. Is there something special that we should think about regarding environmentalists, or is there a broader story to tell with respect to non-voters?
Well, I'll tell you a few things that we have seen. So first, we have come to distrust people's own reasons for not voting, the reasons that they give for not voting. Because what we've come to realize is that even people who don't vote still buy into the societal norm that voting is a good thing. And so when you ask them, hey, why don't you vote? Usually, they will then give you what they think is the most socially acceptable excuse for not voting. Mm-hmm. It's what pollsters call social desirability bias. It's really hard to measure why someone isn't doing something, because usually they'll lie to you and they'll give you the reason that they think makes them look the best. So that's one thing that we have learned. But in particular about environmentalists, a really interesting thing that we have learned is that People view climate change and environmental issues in uniquely apolitical ways in the United States. So what do I mean by that? I mean, when you ask people open-ended questions about how would you go about solving gun violence, most of the ideas they come up with are political responses. You know, pass a law, pass regulations, you know, make it harder to do this, make it easier to do that. Or if you ask people, how do you address immigration? Same thing. They come up with political solutions. But when you ask people, how would you go about addressing climate change or air pollution? The overwhelming majority of their responses are not political. They are personal. They are things like recycle more often, reuse things, educate people about living sustainably. And that is such a weirdly apolitical approach to what is undeniably, Josh, the most global systemic problem our species faces. And so one of the things that's at the heart of why environmentalists aren't voting is that most people simply don't view climate change as a political issue. They view it as a series of personal failings, of individual failings, which we as individuals need to then fix. And so we don't even think about it in the political context. And there's no doubt that that's leading to a lot of environmentalists not even viewing politics as an avenue for obvious change. Instead, they think, okay, I'm going to change what I eat, I'm going to change the electricity I consume, and I'm going to change how I get to work. Essentially, they're thinking about the compost bin instead of the ballot box, and we need to change that.
That's fascinating. So tell us a success story, a particular voter that you've contacted or an election that you think has the organization has made a difference in trying to reach the environmentalist non-voters.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we run all of our campaigns through what's called randomized control trials. And that means we're able to isolate what our impact is while controlling for all outside variables like weather, but also other campaigns and things like that. And one of our biggest successes, I'd say, was way back the end of 2020 and early 2021. Maybe many of your listeners remember that after the 2020 presidential election, the two US Senate races in Georgia went to runoffs. This was Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff were the two Democrats who ultimately won. And this was for control of the U.S. Senate. So the eyes of the world were on Georgia, and $1 billion with a B, $1 billion were spent on these two U.S. Senate races. Now, we at the Environmental Voter Project, we spent about $500,000, still not nothing, but very little compared to that $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And we were able to prove in our randomized control trials that we were solely responsible for boosting turnout of environmentalists by 1 percentage point. And that might not sound like a lot, but 1% is everything in this business. Ask Kamala Harris how big a deal 1% is, and she'll tell you. And that was a huge number because we were targeting over 300,000 voters. So that means 3,000 environmentalists showed up who otherwise would have stayed home on election day. So we were enormously proud of that. But Josh, here's where things get really special. What I am most proud of is what happened after that. Because after the election happened, it was like there was this huge sucking sound and you could hear everybody leaving Georgia. But I told you, we work year-round at the Environmental Voter Project. And so what we did after these two supremely important elections is we got right back to work mobilizing low-propensity environmental voters for the, I kid you not, the Griffin Judicial Circuit District Attorney special election. And for those of you who don't know what a judicial circuit is, it's like if your county's too small that you can't have your own DA, you get together with some other counties and create a circuit and kind of share a DA. So this was like a teeny election that had nothing to do with climate. But this is how you build habitual voters. And so now, when we look at our voter file in Georgia, we see that there are now 117,000 environmentalists in Georgia. who started off as non-voters, and that's why we were targeting them. But as of our most recent look at the voter file a few months ago, we now see that these 117,000 super environmentalists who we've been targeting are voting in every election, not just their federal elections, but also their state and local elections. They have become super voters. And that is the data point of which we are most proud. The fact that when we work in a state year after year after year, we can create well over 100,000 super voters out of non-voters.
And of course, democracy is sustained when all of us participate. Nathaniel Stennett is the founder and CEO of the Environmental Voter Project, which you can find at environmentalvoter.org. Nathaniel, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
It's my pleasure, Josh. Thank you so much for having me.
Josh, the Trump administration has been dismantling some key functions of the EPA, such as the endangerment finding. It's a formal EPA determination that greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide or methane endanger public health and welfare. And you might think that environmentalists would be motivated to vote in droves. But that's not always the case. What did Nathaniel Stennett have to say about that?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how he pointed out that most people think they want to respond to the environmental crisis by doing something personal, right? Doing something about how they interact with the world. And they just don't see politics as the way to change things, right? He said that environmentalists think of the compost box and not the ballot box. That line really resonated with me because it spoke to the political powerlessness that many of us feel, right? That many of us feel like we can't make a difference. But he's got all this great data showing that it can. Now, of course, the organization is nonpartisan, so they're not focused on one side or the other. They're focused on getting environmentalists to go to the ballot box because, as he said, politicians will only listen to the people who are showing up. You know, why do you think that we have so much focus on issues like Social Security and issues that where older people care a lot more about than younger people? Because younger people don't vote at the rates that older people do. Environmentalists don't vote at the same rate as some other constituencies. And so their voices are left by the wayside by the people in charge.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky Election Law and Voting Research Professor Josh Douglas.
Literacy and democracy go hand in hand. Literacy affects almost every aspect of a person's life. After all, civic participation depends on voters being literate enough to understand the law, their rights, and the news that shapes public debate. But literacy development is dependent on many factors, including where you live, your household circumstances, and perhaps most importantly, whether you have access to books. Many Americans are fortunate enough to own a personal collection or have a local library within traveling distance. Still, this is a luxury some don't have in certain regions of the United States, and especially in developing areas of the world. That's exactly what Harriet Van Meter witnessed when she visited India in 1965. She saw long lines of people waiting not for food, medicine, or drinking water, but for books. That experience was the catalyst for the International Book Project, which she started in 1966 as a one-woman operation focused on shipping books to India out of her basement in Lexington, Kentucky. Now, 60 years later, Van Meter's grassroots legacy has led to more than 8 million books being shipped to 168 countries around the world. Here to discuss the International Book Project and its impact on civic literacy is its executive director, Rachel Ray. Rachel, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much, Josh. I'm very excited to be here.
So first, just tell us a little bit about IBP, the International Book Project, what it is and what it does.
Absolutely. So our mission is to partner with organizations across the world to ship them books at low to no cost. We do this for schools, for libraries, community centers, refugee camps, detention centers, you name it. Any NGO, nonprofit, library, or school can reach out to us and request books, and we'll work with them to send them books. It's super important for us to work with our partners to send them books that will have the greatest impact. So we curate all of our shipments to our partners, to the books that they actually need. And also very important to us is to send books that are in very good condition because they need to last a very long time.
And so where do you get these books?
We get them from a number of different sources. We have some amazing local folks that donate their books when they're done reading them. We work with schools and libraries. When they weed their collections, they'll send them to us. And we also work with a couple different retail outlets that have philanthropic arms to get books.
And sometimes these shipments are what, you know, 50 or 100 books, mm-hmm. but sometimes they're in the thousands, right?
Exactly.
What's kind of the largest shipment that you've sent?
That we have sent?
Recently, at least, yeah.
The biggest one we've sent recently was last year we sent a container of about 30,000 books to Malawi in Africa.
Wow. So you work a lot in underdeveloped countries, right? Sending books to places that really don't have access in the same way that we might. And you're partnering with an Australian volunteer organization to develop a library system in the South Pacific nation of Tonga. Tonga actually had no libraries, right, as recently as 2019. So how does this kind of partnership speak to the importance of the work, especially in underdeveloped countries?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited about this particular project because we're going to help jumpstart an entire library system across the island chain of Tonga, which is literally hundreds of islands. About 50 to 60 of them are habited. And our volunteer is going to serve as the central processing point and ship all of these books out to these inhabited islands, along with a central organizing system. So it's a really great project for us for a lot of reasons. But the main reason falls under that banner of access, because these folks that live on these remote islands that don't have libraries can't just, you know, hop in a car and drive to the library. It's getting in a boat and going to a library. Mm-hmm. So being able to access books on their own island is huge.
We're going to get to the connection to democracy in just a few minutes. But I'm curious if you could say a little bit more about what getting books to these people in a place like Tonga really means to their daily lives. And how does it, do you think, change their experience and their interaction in the world?
For Tonga specifically?
Or for any of these countries, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, having access to books, there's been a jillion studies done that shows the correlation between having access to books, obviously literacy, but also things like highest grade completed, incarceration rates, maternal and infant mortality rates are all tied to literacy. So getting books to these remote places improves outcomes in all of these areas for people.
That's fascinating. And do you see, I mean, do you hear back from these organizations in these other countries? Do you get a sense of, you know, these people? Tell us a little bit, maybe some of your, one of your most interesting stories about the feedback or response you've
received.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we get lots of feedback from our partners, which is fantastic. Two years ago, the container we sent to Malawi has been a really great project because our partner there, a gentleman named Brother Francis, has basically taken it upon himself to distribute every one of these 30,000 books across the entire country of Malawi. So he visits a new school, and it's still ongoing. He got this container over a year ago. He visits a new school, he distributes to these kids, and he sends us pictures and updates every single time. I have a folder in my email dedicated to Malawi and Brother Francis, and it has like 158 emails in it.
Because
it's really amazing.
And is it mostly children that these books are reaching, or is it adults as well?
It is both, but our number one request is for children's books.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as you said, without access to these books, that really impedes their education.
Absolutely.
Right? And which has so many impacts across all aspects of their lives. Now, in addition to the international work, and of course, the organization's name is International Book Project, there's a lot of work happening here at home, right?
You're
a Kentucky-based nonprofit organization. One of the initiatives I know is called Books in the Bluegrass. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, absolutely. Books in the Bluegrass is I love all of our local programs, but Books in the Bluegrass is really close to my heart. We work with other local nonprofits, which is great. I love cooperation between nonprofits. So like Habitat for Humanity, One Parent Scholar House, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, and we work with them to provide the families that go through their programs with a completely free, fully stocked bookshelf. And again, I talked about curation before. We curate the books that are on those bookshelves to the ages of the people that are in the home and the reading level of the people in the home.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's, you know, toddlers, we're putting board books and picture books. But if it's all adults, there might be cookbooks or home repair books or gardening books. They let us know what they need. And we work with them to supply them with those books.
And you also help to set up bookshelves for refugees, right?
Yes,
who are coming to America. So tell us about what that looks like and why that's so important for these individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a really wonderful, longstanding relationship with Kentucky Refugee Ministries. And through this Books in the Bluegrass program, we're able to provide those families with these bookshelves, which is great because in a lot of cases, these families that are transplanted here for whatever reason often don't have transportation. So they don't have the ability to get to libraries or to bookstores. There might be financial constraints in terms of buying books. So for us to be able to provide reading level appropriate books for these families is great. It helps them with their English fluency, and we even invite them, once they've gone through all the books on their bookshelves, they can bring them back in, trade them out for books at a higher level.
That's great. And then, you know, we've talked about your international work, we've talked about your Kentucky work, and you have a program that bridges
ties it all together,
right? And it's actually called Books as Bridges.
Yes.
So how do you ensure that people in Kentucky who are benefiting from these books actually get some of that international experience?
Well, the Books as Bridges program is really great. It's our, reductively, it's a pen pal program, but it's a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Our education coordinator works with a primarily Kentucky classrooms, but we have some others scattered across the U.S. We pair a domestic classroom with an international classroom, and they do a letter exchange. They exchange 3 letters per year. They also exchange what we call a cultural package. So each classroom will put together a box that has little mementos or pieces of art or snacks even to trade with our counterparts. One of our Ugandan partners gave us a whole bag full of handmade bracelets.
Mm.
I'm actually wearing one right now.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. We love it when we get those packages because we love to see what's in them.
Mm-hmm.
So they trade these cultural packages. And then our educational coordinator also teaches a couple of lessons on the partner country to the Kentucky classroom. So we're teaching kids about all these different cultural systems and music and language and food and dance. And then we also send a box of books to the international classroom to help build up their library.
We're speaking with Rachel Ray, the executive director of the International Book Project that sends books all over the world and to classrooms in Kentucky and throughout the United States. And I want to shift our conversation now to this aspect of civic literacy, right? This is a show about democracy, and we've had a great conversation so far about what IBP, the International Book Project, does. But I want to understand the ways in which IBP can be thought of as a civic health organization that's perhaps indirectly involved in protecting democracy. What do you think of that framing of the organization's work?
I mean, I would agree 100%. When you sent over the questions we were going to talk about, of course we're a civic health organization, but then I actually had to think about it a little bit. So it's a great exercise for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
So organizations like IBP, other organizations that promote literacy, absolutely help foster and protect democracy. The more literate a population, the more likely they are to be civically engaged, informed about social issues, and involved in their community. So all of these things promote civic health. And increased literacy rates are also tied to economic stability. Employment opportunities increase with literacy rates, and that leads to decreased poverty. And all of these things work together to promote civic health.
So really, having access to books is in some ways a democracy measure. It helps people become more literate, which helps them engage in the civic life of their community. And I've often said that democracy has to be so much more than just voting.
Yes.
It's got to be about engaging in one's community.
Oh, absolutely.
But you can't do that if you don't have access to the tools to make you a literate member of society. Could you give us an example, either here in the U.S. or abroad, where you've seen actually access to books correlate with maybe stronger civil institutions or better civic health?
The clearest examples are the work that we do with libraries. I mean, I think libraries are one of the most important civic institutions we have as a nation. We worked with a school in Michigan late last year who had to close their library in 2019. And when they finally secured the funds to reopen it, they opened the boxes where their books were stored and found that over 80% had been damaged by water.
Oh, wow.
So they had almost nothing. So they reached out to us, and we had donors both here and in Michigan help get this project off the ground, and we were able to send them a pallet of books to kind of jumpstart that library reopening.
And let's just imagine a world where they didn't have the access to restart that library and to really restock it. You know, what would that mean for that community?
Well, it would mean all of these things that we've talked about not improving. So all these things that increase literacy helps.
Mm-hmm. As long as you have that access.
As long as you have that access. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been studies that show when we talk about our Books in the Bluegrass program, one of the big factors is how just having books in the home increases literacy rates, but also people who have 80 books in the home. That's all, 80 books in the home.
Mm-hmm.
Children tend to perform better, grades higher than they already do. So,
wow, just 80.
Just 80.
Wow. And it reminds me of a study I've seen that says that the number of words that you're exposed to as a very young child has a huge impact on your overall trajectory, your
Absolutely.
Education, but your economic trajectory and everything, just the number of words that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously having access to books is
That's
part of that as well.
That's absolutely tied to that. The more words you read, the more words you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we're obviously at a very polarized time in the United States. The International Book Project is a nonpartisan and nonprofit organization. But, you know, even books these days are getting politicized. Mm-hmm. We hear calls to ban books. Mm-hmm. We hear calls to take books out of libraries. How does an organization like yours, which is just trying to get access, and you say, you know, obviously you curate the shipments to different countries, the bookshelves you're setting up for new families who have entered the United States. But how do you navigate that partisanship and polarization that might even affect books?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's astounding to me that so basic of a concept as literacy can be divisive. To me, there are no drawbacks in increased literacy, but I guess not everybody sees it that way. I've only been at IBP for a little over a year, and fortunately, we've not had any major kerfluffles in that area. But we do occasionally get requests from folks who want us to make sure there's no books that have LGBTQ themes or trans themes, things like that. We don't accede to those requests. We're not in the business of censoring books. And we'll tell folks that, and if it is up to them if they opt to get a shipment from us or not.
And how do you navigate kind of the overall conversation about politics? I mean, is it just simply that, you look, we don't censor and you get to decide?
Yep.
You know, what's your view on the censorship that we're seeing, you know, that you said censorship, this idea that, you know, we're banning books or there's certain books that we shouldn't have in libraries. What's your overall view of that whole conversation?
Well, it's insane.
Short and sweet, I guess.
To put it bluntly, I mean, the banning of books is, I mean, it's straight out of Fahrenheit 451. It's a way to limit people's knowledge. It's a way to impose one person's set of beliefs on another person, which I don't believe in, obviously. A lot of books that tend to be banned are from marginalized voices. So censorship aims towards a homogenized voice, which is not good for civic health. It's not good for empathy. It's really just not good for anything.
And again, the focus here being civic health, being an informed, engaged member of your community, means that you need to be exposed to issues and views from all sides.
Absolutely.
From, you know, the all different perspectives of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about literacy. We've been talking about informed citizenship. We've mm-hmm. been talking about civic health. What else should we do as a country to ensure we have improved literacy, improved access to civic education? I can put it this way. If you had a blank check from mm-hmm. Congress, and like Congress would never spend, unlimited money. But let's just
right.
pretend that Congress gave you a blank check and said, you should spend this on literacy investment. What would you do?
I'd protect our libraries. I've spoke earlier about how important libraries are. Giving equitable access to books, which is our mission as well, is so important. And libraries don't just supply books. They are a safe space for all kinds of people. They have programming for young people. They provide access to computers. So protecting libraries, funding libraries, investing in libraries, I think is hugely important to inform citizenship.
Okay, so we're going to protect libraries. What mm-hmm. about, would you do anything different in schools in the way that we're approaching literacy and civic education?
Yeah, I mean, education cuts are extremely deleterious to our advancement as a people. I mean, the plans to cut funding for education, the elimination of DEI initiatives, various program cuts, you know, they're very worrisome. And we need to be an educated people to be able to be informed about what is going on in this country and to be able to affect positive change.
So this is a show called Democracy Optimist. And people often say to me, how are you a democracy optimist, given some of the challenges
right.
that we seem to see in today's environment? And my answer is always, optimism is not, I think everything's great, and I think we've never had in this country everything great. It's about seeing a path for the future and sustaining democracy. You have a lot of experience looking internationally mm-hmm. at the global perspective on literacy and democracy. Are you a democracy optimist, given your work?
I am a democracy optimist.
And why is that?
I'm a literacy optimist. I've seen the effects that providing access to books can have on communities, on schools, on individuals. And in the last 30 years, global literacy has increased from 69% to 86%, which is pretty fantastic. There's still a lot of work to do, particularly in marginalized communities, particularly for women. But a jump that big is fantastic. And I like to think we've played at least a little part in that. And I'm also hopeful, we were talking about education a moment ago, I'm hopeful that we will see a swing back to a stronger support of education.
And part of that is having access to books.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
How can people help the International Book Project in its effort to improve literacy?
There are so many ways that you can help us. Come to our store. Shop our bookstore. We have a really amazing little bookstore in our warehouse.
That's here in Lexington, Kentucky.
In Lexington, our warehouse on Delaware Avenue. We do lots of community events. We just last night had Book Bingo at Wise Bird Cider. That's a bi-monthly event. You can subscribe to our e-newsletter on our website to see all the stuff we've got going on. Donating books is huge. I mean, we need books to be able to send books. So mm-hmm. I invite anybody who's listening to look through your books and anything that is in like new or gently used condition that you're not planning on using, bring it to us so we can give those books a second life. And then, of course, as a small nonprofit, I would be remiss if I didn't let folks know that we always need funding, not just to support our programs, but, you know, to keep the lights on in the building. We don't receive any government funding. We're entirely funded by donations. So we're grateful for every dollar that comes in the door.
So while listeners are supporting public radio, they can also support IBP as well. And tell us that website.
It is intlbookproject.org.
Rachel Ray is the executive director of the International Book Project. Rachel, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much, Josh.
In introducing Rachel Ray, Josh, you said literacy and democracy go hand in hand. And the reasons might seem obvious for that, but You drilled down into that statement, and I'm wondering, what did Rachel tell you about the connection between literacy and democracy that stands out in your mind?
You know, my conversation with her reminded me of a Supreme Court case and something that Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote in a case about the right to education. This is a decision out of the 1970s. But Thurgood Marshall talked about how voting and education are so linked that literacy is needed to have an informed electorate. And I think what Rachel Ray was saying is the exact same thing, that we can't have a democracy that actually works unless we are engaged in it. And that requires understanding, and that requires certain skills. And so what she's really referring to is having the kind of skills or muscle that we exercise. And maybe we're not reading about politics, but if we exercise the muscle of reading from an early age, then we start gaining the skills we need to be a productive and informed member of society and a productive and informed member of democracy. So this access to books, I think, really is at the foundation of having an informed and engaged electorate.
Josh Douglas, host of Democracy Optimist, a special production of Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Be with us next week here on Eastern Standard for what drives an upcoming local version of a huge event that took place 40 years ago. You'll hear about a 2026 version scaled down to stretch across much of Fayette County, but with the same big theme of unity. Plus, in Whitesburg, a mosaic mural commemorating the flood of 2022.
They wanted it to commemorate the flood, but also honor the people here, the grit, the strength.
And
Head Start is the gold standard when it comes to early childhood education.
The White House plans a wholesale federal deregulation in favor of state and local licensing. Sharon Price heads the Community Action Council in Lexington.
Licensing asks the question, you know, what is the minimum required to keep children safe? And then Head Start comes in and Head Start asks the questions, what conditions produce lifelong improvements in children's learning, their health, their family well-being?
Next week on Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist's theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond and Landon Palmer, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Email democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist. From Eastern Standard and WEKU.